This is disc number 4.
Four men were following Kaylin, Richard told Nikki and Kara. They were assassins sent by Darkin Rall to kill her. He had already killed all the other confessors. She is the last. So you rescued her? Kara asked. I helped her. Together we were able to kill the assassins. She'd come to Westland looking for a long-lost wizard. It turned out that Zed was the great wizard she had been sent to find. He still held the position of first wizard, even though he had given up the Midlands and fled to Westland before I was born. The whole time I grew up, I never knew that Zed was a wizard, or my grandfather. I only knew him as my best friend in the world. He could sense Nikki looking at him and feel her warm, soft breath against the side of his face. Why did she want this great wizard? Darkin Rall had put the boxes of Ordin in play. It was everyone's worst nightmare. Richard clearly recalled his dread at hearing that news. He had to be stopped before he opened the correct box. Kaylin had been sent to ask this long-vanished first wizard to appoint a seeker. After that first day when I saw her by Trunt Lake, my life was never again the same. Into the silence, Kara asked, "So was it love at first sight?" They were humoring him, trying to take his thoughts off the men who had been slaughtered by a beast sent by Jagang to kill him, trying to take his mind off the monster now coming for him. The thought struck him that maybe somewhere back in the woods, around where they had camped, somewhere in an undiscovered place where he hadn't looked, lay Kaylin's torn remains. Such a thought was so painful to contemplate that it felt like it was crushing his heart. Richard didn't reach up and wipe away the tear that ran down his cheek, but with a gentle touch, Nikki did. Her hand briefly, tenderly caressed his cheek. "I think we'd better try to get some sleep," he said. Nikki drew back her hand and laid her head against his arm. In the darkness, Richard couldn't seem to make his burning eyes close. Before long, he could hear Kara's even breathing as she surrendered to sleep. Nikki softly pressed her cheek against his shoulder as she snuggled up close in their shared warmth. "Nikki," he whispered.
"Yes."
"What kind of torture does Jagang use on captives?" He could feel Nikki take a deep breath and let it out slowly.
"Richard, I'm not going to answer that question. I'm sure you have to know that Jagang is a man who needs killing."
Richard had had to ask the question. He was relieved that Nikki was kind enough not to answer it.
"When Zed first gave me the sword, I told him that I would not be an assassin. I have since come to understand the principled value of preserving life through the task of killing evil men. I wish that driving the Imperial Order out of the New World was as simple as killing Jagang. I can't tell you how many times I wish I had killed him when I had the chance, even though you are right about it not ending the war. I wish I could stop thinking about all the opportunities I missed. I wish I could stop thinking about all the things I should have done."
Richard reached around her and held her trembling shoulders. He felt her muscles slowly relax. Her breathing finally slowed as she slipped into sleep. If he was to find Kaylin, Richard had to get the rest he needed. He closed his eye as another tear leaked out. He missed her so much. His thoughts lingered on that first day he saw Kaylin in the white, satiny, smooth dress that he only much later found out distinguished her as the Mother Confessor. He remembered the way it hugged her shape, the way it made her look so noble. He remembered the way her long hair cascaded around her shoulders, framing her in the dappled forest light. He remembered looking into her beautiful green eyes and seeing the gleam of intelligence looking back at him. He remembered feeling from that first instant, from that first shared gaze, as if he had always known her. He told her that there were four men following her. She asked, "Do you choose to help me?" Before his mind could form a thought, he heard himself say, "Yes." He had never for an instant been sorry that he had said yes. She needed help now.
His last thoughts as he drifted into tormented sleep were of Kalin. Chapter 9. Anne hurriedly hung the simple tin lantern on the hook outside the door. She focused her Han into a bud of heat, and it bloomed into a small flame in the air above her upturned palm. As she stepped into the small room, she gently sent the little flame flitting onto the wick of a candle on the table. As the candle came to life, she closed the door. It had been quite a while since she had received a message in her journey book. She was impatient to get to it. The room was sparse. The plain, plastered walls had no windows. A small table and a straight-backed wooden chair that she had asked to have brought in almost filled the space not used by the bed. Besides its use as a bedroom, the room also made a suitable sanctuary, a place where Anne could be alone, where she could think, reflect, and pray. It also provided privacy for when she used the journey book. A small plate of cheese and sliced fruit sat waiting for her on the table. Jensen had probably left the plate before going off with Tom to stare at the moon. No matter how old Anne got, it invariably brought her a sense of warm inner satisfaction when she saw that look of love in a couple's eyes. They always seemed to think they did a fine job of hiding their feelings from others, but as obvious as it usually was, they might as well be painted purple. At times, Anne privately regretted that she had never had a time like that with Nathan, a time to indulge in complete, simple, extravagant attraction. Expressions of feelings, though, were deemed unbecoming for the prelate. Anne paused. She wondered exactly where she had come to have such a belief. When she had been a novice, they didn't exactly hold classes in which they said, "Should you ever be appointed prelate, you must always mask your feelings." Except disapproval, of course. A good prelate with no more than a look was supposed to be capable of making people's knees tremble uncontrollably. She didn't know where she had learned that either, but she had always seemed to have had the knack. Maybe all along it had been the Creator's plan for her to be the prelate, and he had given her the appropriate disposition for the job. How she sometimes missed it. More than that, though, she had never allowed herself to consciously consider her feelings for Nathan. He was a prophet. When she was prelate of the Sisters of the Light in sovereign authority at the Palace of the Prophets, he had been her prisoner, although they dressed it up in less harsh terms, trying to put a more humane face on it. But it had been no more complicated than that. It had always been believed that prophets were too dangerous to be allowed to run free in the world among normal people. In confining him from a young age, they had denied the existence of free will, preordaining that he would cause harm even though he would never be given the chance to make a conscious choice in his own actions. They had pronounced him guilty without benefit of a crime. It had been an archaic and irrational belief that Anne had unthinkingly adhered to for most of her life. At times, she didn't like considering what that said about her. Now that she and Nathan were both old and found themselves together, however improbable that might have seemed at one time, their relationship could not be described as extravagant attraction. Indeed, she had spent the vast majority of her life enduring her displeasure with the man's antics, and seeing to it that he never escaped either his collar or his confinement in the palace, thereby ensuring his intractable behavior, thereby incurring the ire of the sisters, which made him more unruly yet, round and round in a circle. No matter the uproar he had been able to ignite, seemingly at will, there had always been something about the man that made Anne smile inwardly. At times he was like a child who was nearly 1,000 years old, a child who was a wizard, a child who carried the gift for prophecy. A prophet had but to open his mouth, but to utter prophecy to the uneducated masses, and it would ignite riots at the least, war at the worst. At least, that had always been the fear. Although she was hungry, Anne pushed the plate of cheese and fruit aside. It could wait. Her heart fluttered with the anticipation of what news the message from Verna might bring. Anne sat and scooted her chair close to the simple wooden table. She pulled out the little leather-covered journey book and thumbed through the pages until she again spotted the writing. The room was small and dark. She squinted to help her better make out the words. She finally had to pull the fat candle a little closer. "My dearest Anne," began the message from Verna, written in the book, "I hope this finds you and the Prophet well. I know you said that Nathan was proving to be a valuable contribution to our cause, but I still worry about you being with that man. I hope his cooperation hasn't soured since I last heard from you. I admit to having difficulty imagining him being cooperative without a collar around his neck. I hope you are being cautious. I've never known the Prophet to be entirely sincere, especially when he smiles." Anne had to smile herself. She understood all too well, but Verna didn't know Nathan the way Anne did. He could sometimes get them into trouble faster than 10 boys bringing frogs to dinner, and yet after all was said and done, after so many centuries knowing the Prophet, there really wasn't anyone with whom she had more in common. Anne sighed and turned her attention back to the message in the journey book. "We have been kept quite busy warding off Jagang's siege of the passes into Dahara," Verna wrote. "But at least we have been successful, perhaps too successful. If you are there, prelate, please answer." Anne frowned. How could one be too successful in keeping marauding hordes from overrunning your defenses, slaughtering your defenders, and enslaving a free people? She impatiently pulled the candle closer still. In truth, she was quite jumpy over what Jagang was up to, now that winter had ended and the spring mud was past. The Dreamwalker was a patient foe. His men were from far to the south, in the old world, and weren't used to the winters up north in the new world. While many had fallen victim to the harsh conditions, vast numbers died of the diseases that swept through his winter encampment. Despite losing men in battles, to sickness, and by a variety of other causes, more of the invaders poured north all the time, so that despite everything, Jagang's army inexorably continued to grow. Even so, the man did not waste any of his vast numbers in pointless and futile winter campaigns. He didn't care about the lives of his soldiers, but he did care about conquering the new world, so he only moved when the weather was not a factor. Jagang did not take risks he didn't need to. He simply, steadily, resolutely ground his enemies to dust. Bringing the world to heel was all that mattered to him, not how long it took. He viewed the world of life through the prism of the beliefs of the Fellowship of Order. Individual life, including his, was of no importance. Only the contribution that a person's life could make to the Order was meaningful. With such a vast army in the new world, the forces of the Daharan Empire were now at the mercy of what the Dreamwalker did next. To be sure, the Daharan forces were formidable, but they certainly weren't enough to withstand, much less turn back, the full weight of the seemingly endless numbers of Imperial Order troops. At least not until Richard did whatever he could to effect some change in the tide of war. Prophecy said that Richard was the pebble in the pond, meaning that he caused ripples that spread through everything, affected everything. Prophecy also said, in many different ways and in many different texts, that only if Richard led them in the final battle did they have a chance to triumph. If he didn't guide them in that final battle, prophecy was clear and unambiguous. It said that all would be lost. Anne pressed her fist against the queasy pain in the pit of her stomach, and then pulled the stylus from the spine of the book that was the twin to the one Verna had. "I am here, Verna," she wrote. "But you are the prelate now. The Prophet and I are long dead and buried." It was a deception that had enabled the two of them to save a great many lives. There were times when Anne missed being prelate and missed her flock of sisters. She had dearly loved many of them, at least the ones who hadn't ended up being, in truth, sisters of the dark. The burning pain of that betrayal, not just of her, but of the Creator, never eased. Still, being free of such towering responsibility left her better able to put her mind to other, more important work. While she hated having lost her old way of life, of being prelate and running the palace of the prophets, her calling was to a higher purpose, not to stone walls and the administration of an entire palace of sisters, novices, and young wizards in training. Her true calling was helping to preserve the world of life. In order for her to do that, it was better that the Sisters of the Light and everyone else believed her and Nathan dead. Anne sat up straighter when Verna's writing began appearing across the page. "Anne, I am comforted to have you back with me, if only in the journey book. There are so few of us left. I confess that sometimes I long for the days of peace back at the palace, the times when everything seemed to be so much easier and to make so much more sense, and I only thought it was all so difficult. The world certainly has changed since Richard was born." Anne couldn't argue with that. She popped a piece of cheese in her mouth and then leaned in and began writing. "I pray every day that such order and peace can again settle over the world, and we can go back to complaining about the weather. Verna, I am confused. What did you mean when you said that perhaps you were too successful in defending the passes? Please explain. I await your reply." Anne leaned back in her straight-backed chair and chewed a slice of pear as she waited. Since her journey book was twinned with the one Verna had, anything written in one appeared at the same time in the other. It was one of the few ancient items of magic left from the Palace of the Prophets. Verna's words again began moving across the blank page. "Our scouts and trackers report that Jigang has begun his move. Because he has not been able to break through the passes, the Emperor has split his forces and is taking an army south. General Myford has been fearing that he would do something like this. It's not hard to guess his strategy. Jigang undoubtedly plans to take a large force of his troops down through the Kern Valley and then south around the mountains. Once he is finally clear of all the barriers, he will swing around into the southern reaches of Dahara and then head north. This is the worst possible news for us. We can't abandon the protection of the passes, not while part of his army lies in wait on the other side. And yet, we cannot allow Jigang's forces to sweep up on us from the south. General Myford says we will have to leave sufficient forces here to guard the passes while the bulk of our army heads south to meet the invaders. We have no choice. With half of Jigang's forces to the north, on the other side of the passes, and half heading down to go around the mountains and come up from the south, that leaves the People's Palace right in the middle. Jigang is no doubt licking his chops over such a prospect. And I'm afraid I don't have much time. The entire camp is in an uproar. We only just learned the news that Jigang has split his army and we are rushing to strike camp and start south. I must also divide up the sisters. So many have been lost that there are not many left to divide. At times I feel as if we are in a contest with Jigang to see who will be the last one with a sister left. I fear what will happen to all these good people if none of us survive. If not for that, I would be satisfied to leave this world behind and join Warren in the spirit world. General Myford says we can't spare a moment, and we must be on our way at first light. I will be up the entire night with the arrangements, seeing to it that we have sufficient men and sisters here to defend each of the passes, and inspecting the shields to make sure they are sound. If the Order's northern army were to break through up here, it would be a much quicker death for us. Unless you have something important that must be discussed right now, I'm afraid that I must go." Anne covered her mouth with a hand as she read. The news certainly was disheartening. She wrote an immediate reply so as not to inconvenience Verna. "No, my dear, nothing important just now. You know that you are in my heart always." A message came back almost immediately. "The passes are narrow, so we have been successful at defending them. The Imperial Order can't use their overwhelming power in such narrow places. I feel confident the passes will hold. Since Jigang is stymied by not having been able to cross the mountains, this buys us time while he is forced to take an army all the way south and then back up into Dahara, now that he has the weather to his advantage. Since this is the greatest danger and threat, I will be heading south with the army. Pray for us. We will eventually be forced to meet Jigang's horde in the open plains, where he has the room to throw the full weight of his forces against us. I am afraid that unless something changes, we will have no chance to survive such a battle. I can only hope that Richard fulfills prophecy before we are all dead. Anne swallowed before answering. Verna, you have my word that I will do what I must to see to it. Know that Nathan and I will be dedicated to the task of seeing prophecy fulfilled. Perhaps no one but you would truly understand that this is what I have devoted myself to for over half a millennium. I will not abandon my cause. I will do whatever I can to see that Richard does what only he can. May the Creator be with you and all our brave defenders. You will all be in my prayers every day. Have faith in the Creator, Verna. You are prelate now. Give that faith to all of those with you. In a moment, a message began appearing. Thank you, Anne. I will check my journey book every night as we travel to see if you have any news of Richard. I miss you. I hope we can be together again in this life. Anne carefully wrote her last reply. Me too, child. Fair journey. Anne leaned on her elbows and rubbed her temples. This was not good news, but it was not all bad. Jagang had wanted to break through the passes and end it swiftly, but the passes held, and he had finally been forced to split his army and begin a long, grueling march. She tried to look at the bright side. They still had time. There were any number of things they could still try. They would think of something. Richard would think of something. Prophecy had promised that he held within him the chance for their salvation. She couldn't allow herself to believe that evil would darken the world. A knock on the door made her jump. She pressed her hand over her racing heart. Her Han hadn't warned her that someone was about. Yes? Anne, it's me, Jensen, came the muffled voice from the other side of the door. Anne replaced the stylus and tucked the journey book in her belt as she slid her chair back. She smoothed her skirts and took a deep breath to try to slow her heart back to normal. Come in, dear, she said as she opened the door, smiling at Richard's sister. Thank you for the plate of food. She held an arm back toward the table. Would you like to share it with me? Jensen shook her head. No, thank you. Her face, framed by red ringlets, was a picture of concern. Anne, Nathan sent me. He wants you. He was quite urgent about it. You know how Nathan gets. You know how his eyes get all big and round when he's excited about something. Yes, Anne drawled. He does tend to get that way when he's digging up mischief. Jensen blinked, looking a little startled. I fear you may be right. He told me in no uncertain terms to come get you and bring you there straight away. Nathan always expects people to squeak when he pinches. Anne gestured for the young woman to lead the way. I'd guess I'd best see to it. Where is the prophet, then? Jensen held her lantern up to light her way as she started out of the little room. He's at a graveyard. Anne caught the sleeve of Jensen's dress. A graveyard? And he wants me to come to this graveyard? Jensen looked back over her shoulder and nodded. What is he doing in a graveyard? Jensen swallowed. When I asked him that, he said he was digging up the dead. Chapter 10. In a broad weeping willow, growing on the grassy slope leading down to the graveyard, a mockingbird was spending its night repeating a variety of strident calls meant to defend its territory against interlopers. Ordinarily, a mockingbird's calls, although intended as threats to others of its kind, to Anne's ear could be quite lovely. But in the dead still quiet of night, such piercing whistles, chatters, and whoops were jarring to her nerves. She could hear another mockingbird in the distance making similar threats. Even the birds couldn't achieve peace. Plowing through the long, wild grasses, Jensen pointed as she held the lantern up with her other hand so that Anne could see her way. Tom said that we would find him down there. sweating from the long hike. Anne peered down into the darkness. She couldn't imagine what the prophet was up to. In all the time she had known the man, he had never done such a strange thing. He had done any number of strange things, to be sure, but this just wasn't one of them. As old as he was, one would think that he would want to avoid spending time in a graveyard any sooner than he had to. Anne followed Richard's younger sister as she started down the hill, trying to keep up without running. It seemed like they had already walked half the night, and she was winded. Anne hadn't known of this graveyard, all but forgotten, out in a distant, uninhabited expanse of wilderness. She wished that she had thought to bring along some of the food sitting on the plate back in her room. "Are you sure Tom is still down here?" Jensen looked back over her shoulder. "He should be. Nathan wanted him to stand guard." "For what? To fight off the other body snatchers?" "I don't know, maybe," Jensen said, without so much as a hint of a giggle. Anne wasn't very good at making people laugh. She was good at making their knees tremble, but she just wasn't all that good at jokes. She guessed that a graveyard on a dark night wasn't a good place for jokes. It certainly was a good place to make the knees tremble. "Maybe Nathan just wanted company," Anne suggested. "I don't think that was it." Jensen found a fallen section in the split-rail fence that surrounded the place of the dead and stepped over it. "Nathan asked me to bring you out here, and he wanted Tom to stay and stand guard over the graveyard. I think to make sure there was no one around that he didn't know about." Nathan liked being in charge. Anne guessed that being a gifted Rawl, he could do no less. It was always possible that the whole thing was a pretense just to get Jensen, Tom, and Anne to run around doing his bidding. The prophet was given to a sense of drama, and a graveyard did tend to set a mood. Actually, right then, Anne would have been happy were it nothing more than some idiosyncratic diversion of Nathan's. Unfortunately, she had the queasy feeling that it was something not at all so simple or so innocuous as a bit of theatrics. In all the centuries she had known him, Nathan had at times been secretive, deceptive, and occasionally dangerous, but never to evil ends, although that hadn't always been apparent at the time. During most of his captivity at the Palace of the Prophets, he had tried the sisters' patience until they were ready to scream and tear out their hair. Yet he wasn't maliciously willful or contemptuous of good people. He had an abiding hatred of tyranny and an almost childlike glee about life. No matter how exasperating the man could be at times, and he could be exasperating in the extreme, Nathan had a good heart. Almost since the beginning, despite the circumstances, he had been Anne's confidant and ally against the Keeper getting a foothold in the world of life and against evil people having their way over the innocent. He had worked hard to help stop Jagang. He had, after all, been the one to first show her a prophecy about Richard 500 years before he would be born. Anne found herself wishing that it wasn't dark and that they weren't in a graveyard, and that Jensen didn't have such long legs. It suddenly occurred to Anne why Nathan would need Tom to stand guard and make sure no one was around that they didn't know about, as Jensen had put it. Just like Jensen, the people in Bandakar were pristinely ungifted. They were devoid of that infinitesimal spark of the Creator's gift carried by everyone else in the world. That essential connection made everyone else subject to the reality and nature of magic. But for these people, magic did not exist. The absence of such an inherent elemental nucleus of the gift not only made the pristinely ungifted immune to magic, but since they could not interact with what to them did not exist, it also made them invisible to the power of the gift. If even one parent possessed the pristinely ungifted trait, then it was always passed on to the offspring. These people had originally been banished to preserve the gift in mankind's nature. It had been a terrible solution, to be sure, but as a result the gift had survived in the human race. Had such a solution not been undertaken, magic would long ago have ceased to exist. Because prophecy was magic, it too was blind to these people. No book of prophecy had ever had anything at all to say about the pristinely ungifted, or about the future of mankind in magic now that Richard had discovered these people and ended the banishment. What would happen now was completely unknown. Anne supposed that Richard would have it no other way. He did not exactly enthusiastically embrace prophecy. Despite what prophecy had to say about him, Richard by and large discounted it. He believed in free will. He took a dim view of the notion that there were things about himself that were predestined. In all things in life, and in magic especially, there had to be balance. In a way, Richard's acts of free will were the balance to prophecy. He was the center of a vortex of forces. With Richard, prophecy was attempting to predict the unpredictable. And yet, it had to. Most troubling was that Richard's free will made him a wild card in prophecy, even those prophecies in which he was the subject. He was chaos among patterns, disorder among organizations, and as capricious as lightning. And yet, he was guided by truth and driven by reason, not whim or chance. Nor was he arbitrary. That he could be chaos among prophecy and at the same time be completely rational was an enigma to her. Anne worried greatly about Richard because such contradictory aspects of the gifted were occasionally a prelude to delusional behavior. The last thing they would want was a leader who was delusional. But all of that was academic. The central problem was that while there was still time, they had to find some way to make sure he took up the cause fated to him in the prophecies, and to fulfill his destiny. If they failed, if he failed, then all was lost. Verna's message sat like the shadow of death in the back of Anne's mind. Having spotted their light, Tom appeared out of the darkness, sprinting through the long grass to meet them.
"There you are," he said to Anne. "Nathan will be happy that you're finally here. Come on and I'll show you the way."
By the brief glimpse she got in the weak yellow light from the lantern, Tom's face looked troubled. The big Daharan led them deeper into the graveyard, where in areas there were rows of gently mounded graves outlined in stones. These had to be newer, because most of what Anne could see was nothing but tall grass that over time covered over stones and the graves they marked. In one area, there were a few small granite gravestones. They were so weathered, it could only be that they were ancient. Some of the graves were marked with simple boards with names carved in them. Most such markers had long ago turned to dust, leaving much of the graveyard looking like nothing more than a grassy field.
"Do you know what the fat bugs are that are making all the noise?"
Jensen asked Tom.
"I'm not sure," Tom said. "I've never seen them before. They suddenly seem to be all over the place."
Anne smiled to herself.
"They're cicadas."
Jensen frowned back over her shoulder.
"They're what?"
"Cicadas. You wouldn't know what they are. At the last molt, you would have probably still been a toddler, too young to remember. The life cycle of these cicadas with the red eyes is 17 years.
17 years?
Jensen said in astonishment.
"You mean they only come out every 17 years?
"Without fail. After the females mate with these noisy fellows, they will lay their eggs in twigs. When they hatch, the nymphs will drop from the trees and burrow into the ground, not to emerge for another 17 years, where their life as adults will be brief." Jensen and Tom murmured their amazement as they moved on into the graveyard. Anne couldn't see much of anything else by the light coming from Jensen's lantern, except the dark shapes of trees moving in the occasional muggy breeze. As the three of them quietly slipped through the graveyard, cicadas chirped incessantly from the darkness all around. Anne used her Han to try to sense if anyone else was about, but she didn't feel anyone other than Tom, and somewhere in the distance, one other person, no doubt Nathan. Since Jensen was one of the pristinely ungifted, she was intangible to Anne's Han. Like Richard, Jensen had been fathered by Darkenroll. Births of the pristinely ungifted, such as Jensen's,
had been an unexpected and random side effect of the magic of the bond carried by every gifted Lord Rull. In ancient times, when that trait began to spread, the solution had been to banish the pristinely ungifted, sealing them away in the forgotten land of Bandakar. After that, all ungifted offspring of the Lord Rull were put to death. Unlike any past Lord Rull, Richard had been jubilant to discover that he had a sister. He would never allow her to be put to death for the nature of her birth, nor would he allow her and those like her to be forced into banishment. Even though Anne had been around these people for some time now, she was still not used to how disorienting it could be. Even when one of them was standing right in front of her, Anne's ability said that there was no one there. It was a haunting sort of blindness, a loss of one of her senses that she had always taken for granted. Jensen had to take long strides to keep pace with Tom. To keep up with the two of them, Anne had to trot. And then, as they came around a small knoll, a stone monument loomed up into view. The light from the lantern lit one side of a rectangular stone base that was a little taller than Anne, but not as tall as Jensen. The coarse stone was heavily weathered and pitted, with stone molding carved around recessed squares on the sides. If it had ever been polished, the stone no longer showed any evidence of it. As the lantern light swept across the surface, it revealed layers of dirty discoloration from great age, as well as the mottled growth of mustard-colored lichen. Atop the imposing base sat a large carved urn with stone grapes hanging out over one side. Grapes were a favorite of Nathan's. As Tom led them around the front of the stone monument, Anne was astonished to see that the rectangle of stone sat off kilter. On the far side, faint light oozed up from beneath it. It appeared that the entire monument had been pivoted aside, revealing steep stone steps that led down into the ground, down into the soft glow of light. Tom gave them both a meaningful look. "He's down in there." Jensen leaned over a little and peered into the steep cavity.
"Nathan is down there, down those steps?"
"I'm afraid so," Tom told her.
"What is this place?" Anne asked.
Tom shrugged apologetically.
"I'm afraid I have no idea. I didn't even know this was here until just a little while ago when Nathan showed me where I could find him. He told me to send you down just as soon as you got here. He was pretty insistent about it. He doesn't want anyone knowing this place is here. He wanted me to stand lookout and keep any people away from the graveyard, although I really don't think anyone ever comes out here anymore, especially at night. The Bandakaran people aren't the kind to go looking for an adventure."
"Unlike Nathan," Anne muttered. She patted Tom's muscled arm. "Thank you, my boy. Best do as Nathan said and stand watch. I'll go down and see what this is all about."
"We'll both go," Jensen said.
Chapter 11. Driven by worried curiosity, Anne immediately started down the dusty steps. Jensen followed close on her heels. A landing turned them to the right and down another flight. At a third landing, a long run of stairs turned to the left. The dusty stone walls were uncomfortably close together. The ceiling hunkered low even for Anne. Jensen had to crouch. It felt to Anne like she was being swallowed down through a moldering gullet into the graveyard's belly. At the bottom of the steps, she halted to stare in disbelief. Jensen let out a low whistle. Beyond was not a dungeon, but a strange twisting room unlike any Anne had ever seen. The stone walls zigged and zagged at odd angles, each of its own design and independently of the others. Plastering covered some of the stone walls. In a series of the convoluted angles, the whole room snaked off into the distance, disappearing around projections and pointed corners. The place had a strange orderly disorder about it that Anne found somewhat unsettling. Dark niches here and there in the plastered walls were surrounded with faded blue symbols and decorations that had flaked off in places. There were words as well, but they were too old and dull to be legible without careful study.
Bookshelves as well as ancient wooden tables, all layered in dirt, sat in several places up against the angled walls. Dead still cobwebs, heavy with dust, hung everywhere like drapes meant to decorate the room beneath the graves. Dozens of candles sat on tables and in some of the empty niches, giving the whole place a soft, otherworldly glow, as if all the dead above Anne's head must periodically descend to this place to discuss matters important only to the deceased, and to welcome new members into their eternal order. Beyond the diaphanous curtains of dust-choked cobwebs, amongst four massive tables that had been dragged together, stood Nathan. Disorderly stacks of books were piled high all around him on the tables.
"Ah, there you are," Nathan called from his book fort.
Anne cast a sidelong glance at Jensen.
"I had no idea that this place was down here," the young woman said in answer to the question that remained unasked on Anne's tongue.
Points of candlelight danced in her blue eyes.
"I didn't even know this place existed."
Anne looked around again. "I doubt anyone in the last few thousand years knew this place existed. I wonder how he found it." Nathan snapped a book shut and placed it on a pile behind him. His straight white hair brushed his broad shoulders as he turned back, his hooded, dark azure eyes fixed on Anne. Anne caught the unspoken meaning in Nathan's gaze. She turned to Jensen.
"Why don't you go up and wait with Tom, my dear? It can be a lonely job standing watch in a graveyard."
Jensen looked disappointed, but seemed to understand their need to be left to their business. She flashed a smile.
"Sure, I'll be right up on top if you need anything."
As the sound of Jensen's footsteps on the stone stairs dwindled away into a distant echoing whisper, Anne struck a weaving course through the veils of cobwebs.
"Nathan, what in the world is this place?"
"No need to whisper," he said. "See how the walls turn at all those odd angles? It cuts the echo."
Anne was a little surprised to hear that he was right. Usually the echo in stone rooms was annoying, but this odd twisting room had the hush of the dead.
"There's something strangely familiar about the shape of this place."
"Concealment spell," the prophet said offhandedly.
Anne frowned.
"What?"
"The configuration of the whole thing is in the form of a concealment spell."
He gestured to each side when he saw the puzzled look she gave him.
"It's not the layout of the entire place. The placement of rooms and the course of the various halls and passageways, like at the People's Palace, that is the spell form. But rather, it's the precise line of the walls themselves that make up the spell form, as if someone drew the spell large on the ground and then simply built the walls touching right against that line before hollowing out the middle. Because the walls are a uniform thickness, that means that the outside of the walls are also the shape of the spell form, so that tends to reinforce the whole thing. Quite clever, actually."
For such a spell to work, it had probably been drawn in blood and with the aid of human bones. There would have been an ample supply of those at hand.
"Someone certainly went to a lot of trouble," Anne said as she appraised the space again.
This time she began to recognize some of the shapes and angles in opposition.
"What exactly is this place used for?"
"I'm not entirely sure," he admitted with a sigh. "I don't know if these books were meant to be buried with the dead for all time, or they were being hidden, or there was some other purpose."
Nathan beckoned with his hand.
"This way. Let me show you something."
Anne followed him through several of the zigzags, around turns, and past yet more shelves lined with dusty books, until they reached an area of niches three high to each side. Nathan leaned an elbow against the wall.
"Look here," he said as he pointed a long finger downward, indicating one of the low, arched openings in the stone wall.
Anne stooped and peered inside. It contained a body. All that was left were bones clothed in dusty tatters of robes. A leather belt circled the waist while a strap crossed over one shoulder. Skeletal arms were folded over the chest. Gold chains hung around the neck. Anne could see by the glint of light off the medallion on one of the chains that Nathan must have lifted it for a look, and in so doing his fingers had cleaned off the dust. "Any idea who he is?" she asked as she straightened and folded her hands before herself. Nathan leaned down close to her.
"I believe he was a prophet."
"I thought there was no need to whisper." He arched an eyebrow as he straightened his frame to its considerable height.
"There are a number of other people interred here."
He flicked a hand off toward the darkness.
"Back that way."
Anne wondered if they could all be prophets as well. "And the books?" Nathan leaned down again and whispered again,
"Prophecy."
She frowned and looked back the way they had come.
"Prophecy? You mean all of them? Those are all books of prophecy?" "Most of them."
Excitement bubbled up through her. Books of prophecy were invaluable. They were the rarest of jewels. Such books could offer guidance, provide answers they needed, spare them futile endeavors, fill in gaps in their knowledge. Perhaps more than at any other time in history, they needed those answers. They needed to know more about the final battle in which Richard was supposed to lead them. As of yet, they had not discovered when this battle was to take place. With the frustrating vagary of prophecy, it could yet be many years off. For that matter, it was even possible that it was not to take place until Richard was an old man. With all the difficulties they had faced in the past several years, they could only hope that it was still many years off and they would have time to prepare. Prophecy could help with that. The vaults at the Palace of the Prophets had been filled with thousands of volumes of prophecy, but they had all been destroyed along with the palace to prevent it from falling into the hands of Emperor Jagang. Better to lose such works for all time than allow evil to look upon their pages. But no one knew of this place. This place was hidden beneath a concealment spell. The dizzying possibility spun through Anne's mind.
"Nathan, this is wonderful."
She turned and looked up at the man. He was watching her in a way that made her fidgety. She reached out and placed a hand on his arm.
"Nathan, this is more than we could ever have hoped."
"This is something more than that," he said cryptically as he started back. "There are books here that make me doubt my sanity," he said with a sullen flourish of an arm.
"Ah,"
Anne quipped as she followed along in his wake. "Verification at last." He halted and turned a glare on her.
"This is nothing to joke about."
Anne felt goose flesh ripple up her arms.
"Show me then,"
she said in a serious tone.
"What is it you found?"
He shook his head, seeming to lose his momentary flash of ill humor.
"I'm not even sure."
His usual flamboyance was nowhere in evidence as he moved in among the tables he'd dragged together. His dark mood turned guarded.
"I've been sorting the books."
Anne wanted to hurry him along and get to the meat of his discovery, but she knew that when he was troubled, it was best to let Nathan explain things in his own way, especially when there was arcane speculation involved.
"Sorting them?"
He nodded.
"These here in this pile don't appear to be of any real use to us. Most are prophecy long since outdated, contain only irrelevant records, or are in unknown languages, things like that."
He turned and slapped a hand to the top of another stack. Dust boiled up.
"These here are all books that we had back at the palace."
He swept his hand back and forth in front of the stacks of books piled high on the table behind him.
"All of them. This whole table full."
Her eyes wide, Anne glanced at the shelves and niches going back along the strange room.
"There are a great many more books other than these you have here on the tables. This is only a fraction of them."
"Indeed. I haven't had a chance to even begin to look at them all yet. I finally decided that I'd better send Tom off to find you.
I wanted you to see what I've discovered. That, and there is a lot of reading to do. I've been pulling out one book at a time, checking through it, and placing it on one of the piles on these tables. Anne wondered how many books could still be viable, could still be usable, after thousands of years underground. She had found books before that had been ruined by the effects of time and the elements, especially mildew and water. She peered around, inspecting the walls and ceiling, but she saw no evidence of water leaking through. At first glance, none of these books looked to be damaged by water. How can this place underground be so dry? It would seem that water would seep in through the joints in the stone and make everything down here wet and moldy. I can hardly believe that the books appear to be in such good condition.
Appear being the operative word, Nathan said under his breath.
She turned back to scowl at him. What do you mean? He waved a hand irritably.
In a moment. The interesting thing is, the ceiling and walls are sheathed in lead to help keep out the water. The place also has a shield of magic around it for even more protection. The entrance, too, was shielded.
But the Bandekar people have no magic, and their land was sealed off. There was no one with magic to shield against.
That seal to their banished land finally failed, though, Nathan reminded her.
Yes, that's right, it did.
Anne tapped a finger against her chin.
I wonder how that happened.
Nathan shrugged. How isn't so important for now, although I am concerned about it.
He flipped a hand, as if setting aside the issue.
For the moment, that it did is what's meaningful. Whoever put these books here wanted them hidden and protected, and they went to a great deal of trouble to ensure that they remained that way. The ungifted people here wouldn't be hindered by shields. The weight of the stone monument would be an obstacle in and of itself. But they would have no reason to want to move it in the first place, unless they had a good reason to believe something was under it. What would cause them to suspect such a thing? The fact that this place has remained undisturbed for thousands of years proves that they never realized that this place was down here. I believe that the shields were placed to ward any invaders who might eventually make it into Bandekar, like Jagang's men did.
That makes sense, I suppose, she murmured as she considered it. Not really expecting that the seal to Bandekar would ever be breached, the shields were a simple act of precaution.
Or prophecy, Nathan added.
Anne looked up. There is that. It would take a wizard of Nathan's ability to breach such shields. Even Anne didn't have the ability necessary for some shields. She knew, too, that there were shields placed in ancient times that could only be passed with the aid of subtractive magic.
It's also possible that these books were simply placed here as a way of safekeeping such valuable works, in case anything happened to others of their kind.
You really think they would go to this much trouble to do such a thing? She asked.
Well, all the books at the Palace of the Prophets were lost, now weren't they? Books of prophecy are always at risk. Some have been destroyed, some have fallen into enemy hands, and some have simply disappeared. Places like this provide a backup for those other works, especially if prophecy foretells the need of such a contingency.
I guess you could be right. I have heard about rare finds of prophecy that have been secreted away to preserve them or to keep innocent eyes from viewing them. She shook her head as her gaze scanned the room. Still, I've never heard of any find to approach the likes of this one.
Nathan handed her a book. Its ancient red leather cover was faded nearly to brown. Even so, there was something familiar-looking about it, about the faded gilded ribs on the spine. She lifted the cover and the first blank page.
My, my, my,
Anne softly mused as she saw the title.
The Glendhill Book of Deviation Theory. How very wonderful to hold this in my hands again.
She closed the cover and clasped the book to her breast. It is like an old friend come back from the dead. The book had been one of her favorite volumes on forked prophecy, because it was a pivotal volume that held valuable information about Richard. She had studied it and referred to it so often over the centuries as she waited for him to be born that she practically knew it by memory. She had been heartbroken that it had to be destroyed along with all the rest of the books in the vaults at the Palace of the Prophets. There was still a great deal of information in it about the possibilities of what was yet to come. Nathan plucked another volume from a stack and waggled it before her as he arched an eyebrow. Precession and binary inversions.
No!
She snatched it from his hands.
It can't be!
None of the accounts could ever say for sure that the elusive volume had in fact ever really existed. Anne herself had hunted for it, at Nathan's request, whenever she traveled. She'd also had trusted sisters look for it whenever they went on a journey. There had been leads, but none of the clues ever resulted in anything but dead ends. She looked up at the tall prophet.
Is this real? Many accounts deny that it ever really existed.
Missing, according to some. A mere myth, according to others. I read a little of it, and by the branches of prophecy it fills in, it can only be genuine, or a brilliant fake. I'd have to study it further to tell which, but from what I've seen so far, I tend to believe it's genuine. Besides, what purpose would there be in hiding a fake? Fakes are generally created in order to exchange them for gold. That was true enough.
And here it was all the time, buried beneath the bones.
Along with what I suspect may be a great many other volumes that are just as valuable. Anne clicked her tongue as she again gazed about at all the books, her sense of awe growing by the moment.
Nathan, you've uncovered a treasure of incalculable value.
Perhaps, he said. When she shot him a puzzled frown, he lifted a hefty tome off the top of another stack. You won't even believe what this is. Here, open it, and read the title yourself. Anne reluctantly set down Precession and Binary Inversions in order to take the heavy book from Nathan. She set it on the table, too, and bent close. With great care, she lifted open the cover. She blinked, then straightened.
Celeron's seventh task.
She gaped at the prophet.
But I thought there was only one copy and it was destroyed.
One side of Nathan's mouth cocked with a quirky smile. He held up another book. 12 words left for reason. I found Destiny's twin as well. He waggled a finger at a pile. It's in there somewhere. Anne's jaw worked for a moment until the words finally came.
I thought we had lost those prophecies for all time.
The odd smile still on his lips, he only watched her. She reached out and gripped his arm.
Could we be so fortunate that there really were copies made?
Nathan nodded, confirming her guess. The smile ghosted away. Anne, he said as he handed her 12 words left for a reason. Take a look through here and tell me what you think. Puzzled by the grim expression that had settled on his face, she placed the book in a clear spot and began carefully turning pages. The writing was a little faded, but no more so than any book its age. For as old as it was still in good condition and quite legible. 12 Words Left for a Reason was a book containing 12 core prophecies and a number of ancillary branches. Those ancillary branches, when carefully cross-referenced, connected actual events to a number of other books of prophecy that were otherwise impossible to place chronologically. The 12 core prophecies actually weren't all that important. It was the ancillary branches that served to link other trunks and branches in the tree of prophecy that made 12 words left for reason so invaluable. Chronology was often the most trying problem facing those working with prophecy. It was often impossible to tell if a prophecy was going to unfold the next day or the next century. Events were in a constant state of flux. The setting of prophecy in the context of time was essential, not just to know when a particular prophecy was to become viable, but because what was of overriding importance next year might be nothing more than an unimportant minor event if set in the environment of the year after. Unless they knew which year the prophecy took place, they didn't know if it foretold danger or simply a matter of note. Most prophets, when they set down their prophecy, left it up to those who would come later to fit it into its proper place in real-world events. There was no clear consensus on whether this had been done deliberately through carelessness or because the prophet, in the throes of having his visions, had never realized how important and difficult it would later be to chronologically place his vision. She had often observed with Nathan that a prophecy was so crystal clear to the prophet himself that he simply failed to comprehend how formidable a task it would be for others to read and fit into the puzzle of life.
"Wait," Nathan said as she turned the page. "Go back a page."
Anne glanced up at him and then flipped the vellum back.
"There," Nathan said as he tapped a finger to the page. "Look here. There are several lines missing."
Anne peered at the small gap in the writing, but didn't see what was so meaningful about it. Books often had spaces left blank for a wide variety of reasons.
"So?"
Rather than answer, he rolled his hand, motioning for her to go on. She started flipping over the pages. Nathan thrust his hand in to stop her and tapped another blank spot so she would note it. He then urged her to continue. Anne noticed that the blank places became more frequent. Finally, she came to entire pages that were blank. Even that, though, was not unheard of. There were any number of books that simply ended in the middle. It was thought that the prophet who had been working on such books had most likely died, and those coming after didn't want to interfere with what a predecessor had done. Or perhaps they wanted to work on branches of prophecy which were more interesting or relevant to them.
12 Words Left for Reason is one of the few books of prophecy that is chronological, he reminded her in a soft voice. She knew that, of course. That was what made the book such a valuable tool. She couldn't imagine, though, why he had felt it important to point it out.
"Well," Anne said with a sigh as she reached the end, "it is odd, I suppose. What do you make of the blank places?"
Rather than answer her directly, he handed her another book.
"Subdivision of Burkett's Root. Take a look."
Anne turned the pages of yet another priceless find, looking for something out of the ordinary. She came across 3 blank pages followed by more prophecy. She was growing impatient with Nathan's game.
"What am I supposed to see?"
Nathan was a moment in answering. When he finally did, his voice had that quality about it that tended to run shivers up her spine.
"Anne, we had that book down in the vaults."
She was still not following what was obviously of critical importance to him.
"Yes, we did. I remember it quite well."
"The copy we had didn't have those blank pages."
She frowned and then turned back to the book. She leafed through the pages again until she found the empty spot.
"Well,"
she said as she studied the place where the prophecy ended, and then where an entirely new branch of prophecy resumed after the empty pages.
"Maybe whoever made this copy, for some reason, decided not to include some of it. Perhaps they had sound reason to believe that the particular branch had been a dead end and, rather than include dead wood in the tree of prophecy, they simply left it out. Such pruning is not uncommon."
Then, because they didn't want to make it appear they were trying to deceive anyone, they went ahead and left the appropriate space blank to denote the deletion. She looked up. The prophet's azure eyes were fixed on her. Anne felt sweat trickle down between her shoulder blades.
take a look at the Glendale Book of Deviation Theory, he said in a quiet voice without taking his penetrating gaze from her. Anne broke contact with that gaze and pulled the copy of the Glendale Book of Deviation Theory close. She flipped through the pages, as she had done with the previous book, if a little faster. There were blank pages, only more of them. She shrugged. Not a very accurate copy, I'd say. Nathan impatiently reached in with a long arm and turned the stack of pages back to the front. There, on a page at the beginning, all alone, was the author's mark.
Dear Creator,
Anne whispered when she saw the little symbol. It still glimmered with the magic the author had invested in his mark. She felt goosebumps tingle up from her toes.
This isn't a copy. This is the original.
That's right. If you recall, the one we had in the vaults was a copy.
Yes, I remember that ours was a copy.
She had assumed this one as well had been one of a number of copies. Many of the books of prophecy were copies, but that didn't diminish their value. They were checked and marked by respected scholars who then left their own mark to vouch for the copy's accuracy. A book of prophecy was valued for the precision and veracity of its content, not because it was the original. It was the prophecy itself that was valuable, not the hand that had set it down. Still, to see the original of a book she loved as much as she loved this particular volume was a memorable experience. This was the actual book, written in the hand of the prophet who had given these precious prophecies.
Nathan, what can I say? This is a personal delight for me. You know how much this book means to me.
Nathan took a patient breath.
And the blank pages?
Anne shrugged with one shoulder.
I don't know. I'm not really prepared to venture a guess. What are you getting at?
Look at the place where the blanks fit into the text.
Anne turned her attention back to the book. She read a little of the text before one of the blank areas, then read some of what followed. It was a prophecy about Richard. She randomly picked another blank place, reading before the blank area and after. It was another section about Richard.
It would seem, she said as she studied a third place, that the blanks appear in places where it talks about Richard.
Nathan was getting more edgy looking by the moment.
That's only because most of the Glendale Book of Deviation Theory is about Richard. That pattern of blank pages associated with him doesn't hold true when you start looking at the other books.
Anne lifted her arms and let them fall to her sides.
Then I give up. I don't see what you see.
It's what we're not seeing. It's the blank places that are the problem.
What makes you say that?
Because, he said, with a little more force in his voice, there is something quite odd about those blank sections.
Anne pushed a stray wisp of gray hair back into the bun she always wore at the back of her head. She was becoming frazzled.
Like what?
You tell me, he said. I would bet that you could practically quote the Glendale Book of Deviation Theory.
Anne shrugged.
Perhaps.
Well, I can quote it. The copy we had back in the vaults, anyway. I went through this book, testing it against my memory.
For some reason, Anne's stomach was churning with anxiety. She began to dread that the copy they had back in the vaults at the palace might have had fraudulent prophecy filling in what the original author had left blank. That was almost too overwhelming a deception to contemplate.
And what did you discover?
She asked. That I can quote this original exactly. No more, no less.
Anne sighed in relief.
Nathan, that's wonderful. That means that our copy wasn't filled with fabricated prophecy. Why would you be troubled because you can't remember blank places? They are blank. There is nothing there. There is nothing to remember.
The copy we had back at the palace didn't have any blank places.
Anne blinked as she thought back.
No, it didn't. I remember it well.
She offered the prophet a warm smile.
But don't you see? If you can quote this one, no more or no less, and you learned it from our copy, then that means that whoever made the copy simply pulled the text together rather than include the meaningless blank places left by the original prophet. The prophet probably left blank places as a provision in case he had any further visions about the prophecies, and he needed to add to what he had already written. Apparently, he never had that need, so the blanks remain.
I know that there were more pages in our copy.
I'm not following you, then.
This time it was Nathan who threw up his hands.
Anne, don't you see? Here, look at the book.
He turned it toward her.
Look at this next-to-last branch of prophecy. It's one page and then six blank pages. Do you remember any branch of prophecy in our copy of the Glendhill Book of Deviation Theory that was only one page? No. None were this short. They were too complex. You know that there is more to the prophecy. I know there is more to the prophecy. But my mind is as blank as these pages. What was there is not only missing from the book, but it's missing from my mind as well. Unless you can quote me the rest of the prophecy that you know should be there, then it's missing from your mind as well.
Nathan, that's just not... I don't see how...
Anne sputtered in confusion.
Here, he said as he snatched a book from behind him. Collected Origins, you must remember this.
Anne reverently lifted the book from his hands.
Oh, Nathan, of course I remember it. How could one forget such a short but beautiful book?
Collected Origins was an exceedingly rare prophecy in that it was written entirely in story form. Anne loved the story. She had a soft spot for romance, although she never admitted it to anyone. Since this tale of romance was actually a prophecy, that made it an official requirement that she be familiar with it. She smiled as she lifted open the cover of the small book. The pages were blank. All of them.
Tell me, Nathan said in that quietly commanding deep, raw voice. What is Collected Origins about?
Anne opened her mouth, but no words would come forth.
Tell me then, Nathan went on in that quietly powerful voice of his that seemed as if it could crack stone, a single line of this beloved volume. Tell me who it is about. Tell me how it started, how it ended, or anything in the middle.
Her mind was stark, naked, blank. As she stared up into Nathan's cutting gaze, he leaned a little closer.
Tell me one single thing you remember from this book.
Nathan,
she finally managed to whisper, her own eyes wide.
You often used to keep this book in your rooms. You know it better than I do. What do you remember about Collected Origins?
Not one thing.
This is the end. Disc 4 is in place. Insert disc number 5.